Thanks for staying. The people from HKW told me that the audience in Berlin is very robust. This is why we dare to have three talks in a row. So great to be here. Thanks for the HKW again to allow for this encounter of three different people, three different projects that are kind of trying to work through the idea of situating whatever they do. Es un gran privilegio conocer a ustedes. Gracias por venir. Thanks for coming over, Natalie. That's really great. So, the title of my talk is Working From Here, Territory, Tierra, and Historiography in Times of New Extractivism. And I'm going to stick a lot with the meaning, the probable meaning of working from here. So what is the here I am working from? What could it be? This is actually what my desktop looks like now as I start writing my talk for the event on situating. The assemblage is at the same time typical and atypical for a researcher in cultural theory in the early 20th century, I would say. It is typical with respect to the media formats assembled. I should add that on my Apple computer, more PDFs files are open. My citation program is open to quickly find references. My phone and tablet are at hand. It is a beautiful early autumn day in Austria. The leaves are starting to turn yellow. The sun is just about to dry up the morning fog. I can see that through my window. The assemblage is typical as it represents an obviously privileged mode of working, diametrically opposed to what we heard earlier this evening. My position is very, very safe. I'm not threatened in any sense. I can easily maintain my physical and psychological integrity sitting on my desktop. But there is more to this assemblage, I would say. My, of course, historically contingent situation as a white scholar at an Austrian University of Arts allows me to reach out to written and otherwise recorded traces of precarious and fragile modes of existence while I sit at my desk. And this is probably the core issue of this whole thing. The photo album at the bottom of the pile came to me via my parents, and this might be the untypical part. More about this soon. The children's book on top came via mail order from Australia recently. So did Nico Tassi's The Native World System, published with the Global Player for Academic Publishing, Oxford University Press. Jürgen Riester's book, En la Busca de la Loma Santa, has been living on my shelf for some time already. I acquired the file with information on the Festival Internacional de Música Renanesista y Barroca Americana on the bottom, on the field trip to Bolivia in 2018. Three of the items are from the 1960s, 70s, sorry. Two are quite recent. The publishers are situated in London, La Paz, Sydney, Santa Cruz, and Kufstein, which is in Austria. This here obviously consists of many, many time layers and multiple places. It consists of media items that are fabricated. They are of a nature Bruno Latour famously called immutable mobiles, recordings, translations, and transcriptions that do have the possibility to travel from a specific place, from specific environments, to any other place. Immutable mobiles are the powerful tools of scientific interchange and communication, and they are radically unsituated. So this is a situated assemblage of a lot of things that are unsituated. The pile also consists of some very unique items, items that I reproduce here for the first time as I take photos of them. It's this object here. The item is an assemblage in itself, I would say. The textile cover was woven by a woman in Papua New Guinea in the early 70s. This album contains a collection of photographs from New Guinea. The photographs were taken by my mom and my dad, who, during their 3-year stay as teachers in the Mount Hagen region in Papua New Guinea. The book also contains paintings of masks that were produced by my parents' students and that were bound into the book by my mom after they returned. There's another mask here. And it contains written and printed material related to their stay. A letter by a student in Pidgin and a note in some Austrian church newspaper informing the Catholic public about my parents' project in Papua New Guinea, that's on the bottom. And then there is this image of my mom's in the Austrian talk show, Ohne Maulkorb. I've been fond and very proud of this image for quite some time. Ohne Maulkorb, that means without muscle, and it was a TV show for the young rebellious generation then. My mom was invited to talk about their adventurous plans in New Guinea, and obviously this was her first and probably the only public articulation for their left-leaning idea of development cooperation. This is how she told me the story. She was very young then, only 18, and a fan of liberation theology, a leftist Catholicism that was born in Colombia in the 1970s and there had very strong ties to the guerrilla movements. What is important for me here is to point not only to the heterogeneous nature of this assemblage, but to the highly privileged tier that makes it possible. The economical factors, neo-colonial without doubt, that allow me to mail order a children's book, if it comes up. Mail order children's books from Australia, but also the factors of my upbringing as a kid of two, let's say, secular missionaries, who, with their no doubt well-meant activities, inherited the sometimes ambivalent, sometimes straightforward imperialist endeavors of missionaries that accompanied the colonial conquest since the 16th century. I'm sure that my own interest in the history of missionary enterprises, but also my interest in cultural theory is related to this family history. We grew up with these photos. Our living room was full of masks that frightened me at night. And the story of Liklik Balus, an airplane that is misconceived as a fish by the Highland Man, was one of my first children's books. Only much later I realized how racist the images meant to entertain Papua New Guinean children really were. But I also learned that airplanes play an important role in the millenaristic, prophetic, anti-colonial cargo cults in Papua New Guinea. Much later, I also learned how important ethnographic research in the highlands were to articulate cultural anthropology as a field of knowledge that relates relations, as a situated field of knowledge. I can really only briefly hint today to Marilyn Strathern, who researched in the very area where my parents lived in the early 1970s, they could have met, her interest being gender relations and aesthetic practices. Starting from there, or an appropriated here, I don't know, she developed cultural anthropology as a highly self-reflective and self-critical research practice that relates relationships. And that became so important for Donna Haraway's work, especially this book, Kinship, Law, and the Unexpected. Relatives are often a surprise, are really at the core of the theoretical concepts. So what did I do? I started my lecture with what Joseph Dumit calls an implosion exercise. In his proposition, he fleshes out a kind of a method in what Donna Haraway is doing. He starts his text with a narrative from hers, and I want to quote that in all length because I think that makes very clear what this explosion, the implosion exercise is about. I have taught a course called Science and Politics for a number of years. And one year in particular, it was very early in the morning, a big lecture class at 8 a.m. Were you there, Natalie? 8 o'clock? Good. to get to the lecture hall, we passed this little shop that sold good coffee and chocolate croissants. And just as a way of waking up in the morning, I would ask people to unpack objects, to take a chocolate croissant and lead me through flour and chocolate and butter and sugar and coffee and connect us to world histories that way. I would ask people to pick an object, the t-shirt that the person sitting next to them was wearing, what was printed on it, the label, the very fact of labeling, the fiber composition. If it's got polyester, then take me through the history of Purity Hall and research labs at DuPont. You know, back me up into nitrogen chemistry. If it's cotton, then back me into pesticides and the Californian water projects and where cotton is grown and the length of the fiber and what about what you are wearing on your chest. I would ask people, as a way of talking about science and politics, to take a pencil, a piece of paper, the architecture of the lecture hall that you walked by, pick something, and get the class started by giving me an account of it. So a first step towards situated knowledge is to create a sense for the contingent and non-innocent character of this here I work from. The implosion experiment does not only produce dense and rich knowledge about a certain topic, it is also meant to create an attitude, or probably rather an attunement of responsibilities that's similar to the so-called strong program of science studies is working on the issue of objective knowledge. This branch within science studies argues that knowledge becomes more objective when it takes the historical contingencies, political agendas, and subjective frameworks it is constituted by in account. It's not relativistic, it's stronger knowledge. Modes of knowing that cut out these factors are not only politically naive, but in a strong sense, unenlightened, I would say, because they do not have no critical attitude towards their own limitations. After these long preliminaries, and I think that preliminaries are extremely important, they are the measures needed in order to be able to cross borders. This is what preliminary means, that what needs to be taken in account before you cross something. After these long preliminaries, I would like to dive into my research material just a bit and see whether I will be able to surface from it in the here of this evening. My current research is on the longue durée of cultural and economic appropriation in the Bolivian lowlands, the so-called Chiquitania. This is a quite remote area bordering the Amazon, in that way quite similar to the highlands of Papua New Guinea that were so attractive for my parents. It is an area that was quite difficult to colonize, and it was also difficult to control for a long time, both because of this remoteness and the climate, there are heavy floods during winter, and because of the heterogeneous indigenous population that was not easy to rule. Other than in the Andes with the Incas, the Quechua-speaking dynasties, no group had established a centralized regime, and both the conquistadores and the Spanish vice kings had difficulties establishing sustainable and reliable structures of government there. It was in this situation that the Jesuit missionaries, many of them from Austria, so there seems to be a certain attraction to Austrians to go on missions. This is where the Jesuit missionaries entered the scene. From the mid-17th century on, they established a number of their infamous reductions in this area. Those settlements were managed by the Jesuits until its expulsion in 1767. The reductions were spread out in a vast region that is now Bolivian, Argentinian, Paraguayan, and Brazilian territory. The settlements had from 500 up to 10,000 indigenous inhabitants, And at its peak, an estimate of about 160,000 people lived in mission settlements. Certainly, the process of resettlement of the indigenous groups was not as peaceful as depicted in the reports, the relatos of the padres. Even the Jesuit sources I worked with speak of massive physical violence. One of many examples are the reports of the Bavarian padre Julian Knogler, who is quite open about the violence involved in the founding of those settlements. For example, for the settlement Santa Ana de Chiquitos, he has a very, very straightforward narrative, and he calls it geistliche Jagd, a spiritual hunt. And he describes really in detail how the padres employed 15 or 60 converts to search and literally hunt down a new group of Christians. The initial act for the founding of a settlement was collective baptizing. Subsequently, the neophytes underwent conversion to a monotheist, a universalist religion. This included teaching practices of prayer, listening to biblical stories, and instruction to central theological concepts. Indoctrination took place in the native language, in the native languages. This is one of the reasons why the padres were also the first ones to write grammar books in their respective languages. So this is a connection to the new alphabet school. They had to formalize the languages they found in order then to use it for evangelization. The standard narrative of the founding of a reduction goes as follows. This multitude of nations began to be brought under the rule of society, which is the Societas Jesu, around the middle of the last century by means of presence, persuasion, and promises. Through the constancy of the missionaries in their endeavors and exertions, and at the cost of the lives of some of them, these wild beasts were tamed. They managed to make men out of them in order to make them Christians. In the process of reduction, ample and regular towns were built, magnificent temples were erected with beautiful ornaments, in which on festive days one could hear an excellent music of voices and instruments, organs, harps, harpsichords, violins, strings, basses, flutes, shawms, etc. So the cultural dimension of colonial rule was really taken very seriously. This report, however accurate it may be, stresses certain motives that reoccur in many other sources. Firstly, the Jesuits' ability to construct an orderly and productive community that expresses itself in musical performance of great excellence. A prominently mentioned feature is the fact that in the settlement, a multitude of nations was under one rule. Another topos is the Jesuits' strategy of evangelization with presence, persuasions, and promises, as opposed, of course, to forced conversion and physical coercion. The concept of the reduction was not of Jesuit origin, though. It was rather the result of an ongoing conflict between the Spanish crown and the conquistadores. Since the early 16th century already, laws had been implemented to protect the indigenous communities from the most excessive forms of exploitation through the settlers that led to the depopulation of the Americas. A veritable genocide that led to the massive import of African slaves, and the Jesuit / imperial strategy was kind of was a different perspective on the problems that arose from just killing people whom you needed to work on the plantations. The laws to protect the indigenous people also aimed at regulating and controlling those indigenous communities. In the sixth volume of the Leyes de Indias from 1681, it is stated that the indios should be treated as persons who could not be sold and enslaved, deserved protection from slave hunters and from the encomienderos, plantation owners who mistreated them as cheap and unpaid labor. Yet at the same time, a number of other regulations were also decreed. The reductions were said to have proven to be los medios más convenientes para que los indios sean instruidos en la Santa Fe Católica y ley evangélica y olvidando los errores de sus antiguos ritos y ceremonias vivan en concierto y policía, resolvieron que los indios fuesen reducidos a pueblos y no viviesen divididos y separados por las sierras y montes. I'll translate it, don't worry. The act of reducing in the sense of concentrating the indigenous people is a means to collectivize a population dispersed in mountains and plains to give them Santa Fe Católica, policía and concierto, so to speak, to give them religion, governance and community. Their reduction should also make them forget their idolatrous rites and ceremonies. To achieve this, the settlements were built and governed following a standardized pattern that rendered the territory urban. The first activity the law foresaw was the construction of a church with a door and a lock due to the Indios' alleged lack of a sense for private property. Spatial discipline was considered a key factor. The rural settlements were designed in a typical checkerboard pattern around the Plaza Mayor that you can find in any South American city nowadays. This was lined with buildings of civil and ecclesiastical government. Temporal discipline was considered another key. Together with the church, a sundial and a clock tower were erected in order to battle the assumed careless attitude attributed to the indigenous people. Equally important were legal discipline, respect for authority and social hierarchy, as well as reading and writing skills as a prerequisite for buen policía, the good government. The local chiefs and noble families were thus given functions, and they played a certain role in enforcing local regulations in matters of jurisdiction, for example. As the reductions were considered projects to increase the cultural state of the indigenous people, the betterment of material comfort and the religious cult were part of the project. Remarkable efforts were made for the latter. The churches were decorated abundantly, instruments were imported and shipped, and so forth. Considering that colonial biopolitics of one directional exertion of power, of extinction and extraction of bare life was the dominant model for political economy then in the Americas, the so-called plantation model, those reductions appear as some kind of early examples of a modern governmental mode. The Padres developed a strategy of politics of welfare, one could say, caring for people's lives instead of threatening to take it. They expanded a model of control developed in the closed communities of monasteries. A vital interest for a contemporary political and also cultural theoretical perspective are at least three features of those reductions. First, the reductions as laboratories for modern biopolitics, for governance through education and culture. Second, an installation of politics of territory instead of tierra, the formation of political power structures that were tied to a fixed rational spatial scheme and not to the semi-nomadic, seasonally differentiated modes of agriculture that were in place. So I would really make a division between territory and tierra. The enormous investment in identity politics. Up to 10 different language groups lived in one settlement, and the Jesuit priests established music as a lingua franca, but they also pushed one local language, the Chiquitos, as the official language. One could really say they had to invite a common language in order to be able to govern. And deliberately, they did not push Spanish, as they considered their own political economy superior to the one of the Spanish government. So why is all of this relevant to the day? Why do I think it's still interesting and probably even necessary to talk about those historical issues? Let me just briefly show you a very recent video. It was recorded in San Ignacio de Velasco this summer during the massive burnings that affected the region heavily. Large amounts of wood are now gone, and it is said that it will take 200 years to regrow the woods. And it shows reactions of people to the first drops of rain.
Bueno, el alcalde municipal ha dado gracias por estas primeras gotas de lluvia que han sido esperadas con mucha ansiedad, ¿no?, para todo el pueblo chiquitano, ya que el fuego ha consumido casi más del 70% de todos nuestros bosques, ¿no? Esperemos que esta lluvia sea en abundancia para que así pueda aplacar todos los incendios que tenemos en la Chiquitanía.
Vamos a elevar una oración, darle gracias al Señor por este tiempo tan maravilloso. Dice la palabra de Dios que si se humilla el pueblo, Dios escucha desde lo alto. Y nosotros hemos visto el dolor de nuestros hermanos en Roboré, hemos visto el dolor en la Amazonía, y pues Dios ha escuchado el clamor de su pueblo. La romería que se ha hecho en San José Chiquito, en Roboré, pues Dios ha escuchado el clamor. No vamos nunca nosotros a humillarnos ante una Pachamama, vamos a humillarnos ante la mano del Dios Todopoderoso. Y San Ignacio ha doblado su rodilla delante de Dios y Dios ha escuchado. Hemos sido escuchados por Dios y le damos gracias a Dios porque la lluvia es la bendición desde los cielos. Y vamos a orar en esta noche.
¿Pueden Sie einfach den Sound wegdrehen? Okay, I'll try to wrap up everything really quickly. Why I chose this video is that it has really some very remarkable features. It features, of course, a very localized communal practice, the singing together. They are singing a local church song that refers back to San Ignacio, the founder of the Jesuits. And they are thanking the God from above for the first raindrops. And what the preacher, the last preacher, really says is that they are never going to pray to Pachamama. They will always pray to the God from above. And that is indeed really super interesting in the context of Bolivia that has now a very strong indigenous government that wants to foster values, indigenous values, wants to push indigenous values as a new mode of government. Evo Morales really tries to tie together indigenousness with anti-capitalist politics, and still in the Bolivian lowlands, nobody believes him. So this is this one quotation I have here from Isabel Garcia Impamo, who says that Morales is not representing all of the country. He has always resented indigenous peoples of the eastern lowlands of Bolivia, and so on and so forth. And it's really true that the Morales government really diminished or really fought against indigenous people claiming their lands because of his other politics, which is state capitalism. So here we're in a mix of struggles with and for territories that kind of hark back to the Jesuits' times. And they conceive, of course, of themselves as indigenous as well, with this whole Catholic heritage in their background. Even more complicated, and that's the last thing I'm gonna tell you, is that in the same area, a certain and very strange form of indigenousness has gained political momentum, the so-called Kamba Nation. It's an alliance of indigenous activists with hardcore latifundist white settler colonialists, and they claim for the specific identity of the Chiquitania that they are a good mixture of the glorious indigenous warriors and the Spanish Hidalgos, whereas the indigenous people represented by Morales are some kind of a lesser quality. So this all comes into those very legitimate struggles around territories and rights for territories at the moment. And this is also where I, as a strange kid of secular missionaries, I'm still confused, and where I ask myself how my own approach to the whole thing is. So is it very different to what the Jesuits did when they came? They wanted to learn a lot, they were very curious, and they wanted to transform what they found. They wanted to invent a better people, so to speak. And of course, my need to learn and my need to betterment is not of the kind of the Jesuits. I brought this picture for you. It's a frontispiece for a Jesuit periodical that advertised the missions in Europe in the 17th and 18th century, and it shows, it's called the Neue Weltbot, the New World Herald that flies over all those new lands and is able to bring the Catholic faith. I don't see myself in this position anymore, I swear. It's rather like this. It's an image from Zabriskie Point. Still, I'm as a scholar, obviously, and I'm inheriting the Jesuit endeavor because of my scholarly doings, because they were really also the ones who invented the humanities to some point. So this is where I want to end it, and I just want to propose a couple of questions for our discussion with this explosion, not implosion, in our background. One of the threads we might follow in our discussion are competing and menacing time frames, the long durée of colonial appropriation and extractivism, both economically and culturally, the even longer time of ecological formation and renewal, 200 years to regrow a forest. I don't know how long it will take to revitalize the ecosystem in Buenaventura. So that's the first question, would be those long durations and times of crisis, the need to act, the pressure of urgencies. How do we bring that together? What could be good modes to think together urgency and long time frames? One could probably say that the battle against those who steal the situated futures is the biggest task today. And this is also a question, what are those situated futures and how can we describe them? Then another issue might be quite straightforward, is the relation between political struggle, activism, the arts, and scholarly work. I tried to kind of show you my own, also my own confusion in this whole relationship. And one thing that only after listening to the other two talks seems to be really important for me is the question of how what are the narratives made of that allow us to talk about situations. What time frames do they have? What exactly is time telling? What is time telling? This is already my first question to your to Natalie. And also, of course, all the practices of memory that are related to the practices of narration. What I try to do by trying to find out what those Jesuits did in the 16th century, it's also, I would say, it's a practice of trying to unforget. This has to do with the fact that Austria always thinks it doesn't have any colonial history, and I keep finding out that Austrian, both governmental and ecclesial people were very much involved in those early days. So for me, it's also related to this idea of unforgetting. So I'd like to welcome you back on stage for our discussion. Muchas gracias.